everyone, and welcome to our podcast. My name is Luis Rivera.
And I'm Jordan Donsky.
And today we will be talking about the importance of gender-affirming care, especially for transgender youth. As we were thinking about how to begin today, we figured that it would be impossible to be in Indiana and talk about gender-affirming care without first recognizing the current political climate. Indiana is one of the states leading the charge to ban gender-affirming care, and was recently the 14th state to ban it for transgender youth. Currently, the American Civil Liberties Union is tracking 18 anti-LGBTQ bills in Indiana, which is certainly on the high side when compared to the rest of the country. So, through this podcast, we hope to provide an informative and thought-provoking experience with our listeners, and we'll do this through an analysis of some bioethics and philosophy literature on the topic of gender-affirming care, followed by a more personal look at gender-affirming care and how we navigate it at an all-male institution. We want to outline very clearly our main thesis of this podcast, which is that gender-affirming care is important. It is necessary for trans people to obtain the very human need to feel seen, and all of us can play an active role in providing gender-affirming care here at Wabash.
So, when thinking about gender-affirming care and how it's situated in society currently, it was important for us to visit the past and learn about the history of gender-affirming care. Firstly, gender-affirming care is used to affirm the identity of the person receiving care who is normally characterized as having gender dysphoria, as defined by the Diagnostic Statistic Manual for Mental Disorders. Gender dysphoria is clinically significant distress or impairment related to gender incongruence, which may include a desire to change primary or secondary sex characteristics. Now, not all transgender or gender diverse individuals experience gender dysphoria. The people who do are the ones most in need of this critical form of healthcare.
Also, the word gender dysphoria itself is actually fairly recent. It was actually added to the DSM in 2013 to replace the term gender identity disorder, or GID, which was a term that had been used since 1980. An article by Ellen Fetter titled Regulating Sexuality, Gender Identity Disorder, Children's Rights in the State, details the ways in which the previous term essentially served as a system of oppression for LGBTQ plus youth. Oftentimes being diagnosed with GID meant being referred to an institution that practiced conversion therapy and other harmful and dangerous tactics used to damage such fragile individuals. So the switch to gender dysphoria brought with it a sort of umbrella of protection that significantly shortened the range of diagnosable individuals, and thus shielding the vulnerable queer children who did not suffer from any real clinical distress and did not need to be institutionalized simply for being.
And when we think about specifically children, I think it's important to note that only a small number of children diagnosed with gender dysphoria actually end up showing persistent gender dysphoria into adulthood. This research is detailed in an article by Jack Dresser and Jack Pula titled The Ethical Issues Raised by the Treatment of Gender Variant Prepubescent Children, where they cite a study from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, whose major findings were that only 6 to 23% of boys and 12 to 27% of girls treated in gender clinics actually showed persistent gender dysphoria into adulthood. What this study tells me is that gender-affirming care provided at gender clinics seems to mainly help the young children who struggle with gender dysphoria realize maybe are not transgender. But this safe and supportive environment created through gender-affirming care is clearly an integral part of this child's journey through gender dysphoria, regardless of whether it's persistent or dissistent. We are now going to shift to thinking about a couple of different ways healthcare providers provide gender-affirming care. We'll be focusing more broadly on their overarching interpretation of gender-affirming care, rather than the specific services that each provides. In the Dresser and Pula article that we mentioned earlier, they provide three examples of different approaches to gender-affirming care. The first is Toronto Center for Addiction and Mental Health, where the clinics work with children and gender caregivers to lessen gender dysphoria and decrease cross-gender behaviors and identification. This approach largely seeks to push the children back into the rigid gender boxes that they were prescribed to at birth. The second is the VU University Medical Center in Amsterdam, which uses the fact that most youth diagnosed with gender dysphoria do not have persisting symptoms into adolescence to frame their gender-affirming care offerings. They simply allow the development of gender identity to unfold how it may and support the children regardless. Those who persist are assisted in transitioning, and those who desist are assisted in resituating themselves into birth gender. The third is the gender clinic affiliated with the University of California, San Francisco, and their philosophy is to support children in socially transitioning with medical or surgical interventions. However, they do administer hormones at the onset of puberty. This approach presumes that adult transgender outcome is to be expected, and that these children can be identified, and that children who transition but then desist can revert to their natal gender if necessary with no ill effects.
Thinking about these three approaches, I think it's very clear that the first one is not very affirming, and it seems to simply say that we know that you have gender dysphoria and we're going to work to make sure that you feel like your birth gender. And so clearly that one's just like not the best model.
I think it like further perpetuates and alienates these trans youth kids that are already marginalized.
Yeah, literally. And so, and I mean, but looking at these next two, to me, they both have their own merits. Like the second one is pretty interesting because it is, I think, honestly, the complete opposite. It's just, we will support you. However, if you end up desisting, that's fine. We'll assist you in resituating yourselves. If you end up persisting, that's fine. We'll assist you either way. And so that one seems to be the most progressive to me.
Yeah, it just feels like they are more willing to support than clearly the first one.
Right.
But yeah, I think this can help with affirming trans youth, which is one of the most important parts.
And also, there's another approach that we actually found and both decided was the most idealistic approach and something that would be widely accepted as the pinnacle of gender-affirming care. Chin and colleagues published an article titled Multidisciplinary Care for Gender-Diverse Youth, a Narrative Review and Unique Model of Gender-Affirming Care, and it describes the Gender and Sex Development Program, or GSDP, at the Ann and Robert H. Lurie Children's Hospital of Chicago. And this program, I mean, honestly, they really do have it all. They have two adolescent medicine physicians, an endocrinologist, two clinical psychologists, a child adolescent psychiatrist, a social worker, and an advanced practice nurse as part of their multidisciplinary team. They also provide gender dysphoria therapy groups that seek to promote, quote, gender euphoria, and they have fertility preservation services as well. On top of all of this, they have teen and parent support groups that help to connect the families of the program participants with families with similar circumstances. They provide voice and communication therapy to help gender diverse youth become more comfortable with their voice and alleviate their gender dysphoria, which is just really cool. Similar to this, they offer physical wellness groups that work to dispel the dissatisfaction that many transgender youth feel when comparing their body to their cisgender peers, which is so important. I think both of those are really critical and cutting edge. Lastly, the GSDP program has an arm that focuses on education and community outreach, and they do some really awesome work to help their community. They provide local school personnel with practical solutions to interrupt and prevent gender discrimination. They also collaborate with local and national organizations to develop policy that supports gender inclusivity. Finally, the Lurie Children's Hospital, where this program takes place, actually became the first children's hospital in the United States to release a policy statement supporting transgender youth back in 2016. So clearly, GSCP is a shining beacon of hope and should be used as a model for gender-affirming care by healthcare organizations everywhere. I mean, they truly address the physical, emotional, and social needs of trans youth.
We want now to take some time to dive into a little bit into the mental health side of gender-affirming care. So Barra and colleagues published an article titled Mental Health and Timing of Gender-Affirming Care. And three major findings were particularly interesting when we were thinking about filming this podcast in a college setting. Essentially, the researchers did a longitudinal study of individuals seeking gender-affirming medical care at the Transgender Youth Clinic at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto, Canada. This clinic treats youth seeking medical care with gender dysphoria who are in puberty but under the age of 18. Their main findings were that youth who presented gender dysphoria later in life and thus dealt with all of the struggles that arise as a result of having gender dysphoria later than some of their peers at the clinic had significantly worse mental health. So Barra and colleagues say that these data suggest that incongruent youth who present to gender-affirming medical care later in life are particularly higher risk subset of a vulnerable population. And when we think about being on a college campus right now, like this, when all of those adolescents, youth who were 16 and 17 when they started developing gender dysphoria are very new and very vulnerable at 18, 19, and 20. So I think this shows that college campuses are clearly hotbeds for poor mental health, especially for trans youth. And even more for trans youth who begin to develop gender dysphoria at an older age. So Barra and colleagues also write about how mental health professionals play a critical role in advocating for early access to gender-affirming care and providing appropriate mental health support throughout the transition process.
It's good that you bring up the role of the medical community in all this, Jordan, because there's an interesting article by Jamie Linneman Nelson titled Medicine and Making Sense of Queer Lives, where they did an analysis of the medical community and the role it played in society's treatment of the LGBTQ+ community. And at the end, there's this really impactful quote that essentially sums up the whole article. And so I'm going to go into that now. Quote, "But if the gains already made have depended on building the right kind of social structure and on more people being able to live less fettered lives within them, the role of medicine in contributing to the intelligibility of queer lives is for medicine to become more fully one of those structures, doing its best as it bumps along with us in the contingent world to end practices that marginalize and otherwise harm or wrong queer people in the office, the clinic, the lab, and in precincts where health policy is made." I mean, I think this clearly shows that the medical community can play an integral role in leading the charge to support and affirm queer lives, to support and affirm trans people who truly need them most. And thinking about this, we wanted to personalize this to Wabash specifically. And so we interviewed two of the most important people on this campus when it comes to care of students, Nurse Amadon and Jamie Douglas. Both of them shared their personal perspective on gender-affirming care and how we situate that here at Wabash, and we are so appreciative for their help. Take a listen to our interview with Nurse Amadon.
I've gotten certifications in hormone treatment therapy. I think Dr. Douglas and Dr. Roberts are open to that as well. We've started about, not this past school year, but the year before, we started offering PrEP for people who have high risk factors for HIV, and so we offer that now. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to be more accessible.
What are your thoughts from that interview?
I think it shows that Wabash specifically is acknowledging change, and they are taking the steps
right
to improve, better mm-hmm themselves, mm-hmm, and be prepared for a change that is imminent, I think. Mm-hmm.
I love the fact that there is gender-affirming care in place. We were curious. I mean, when we were first thinking about Wabash specifically in terms of gender-affirming care, we were very curious and honestly skeptical of whether or not we would offer it. And so it was really comforting to talk to Nurse Amadon and hear all the things that we do offer and all of the work that they're doing in the health center for gender-affirming care.
Yeah, I think it's, I don't think anybody or very few people probably know that she's able to provide hormone blockers and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Next, want to listen to Jamie Douglas's interview clip.
I'll just share that my eldest child is trans, so I think he would say that he's trans masculine, so he just had actually gender affirming surgery. Okay. So had top surgery just over spring break, so but he's 32 years old, so that's you know, that's something that his journey has been a very educational one for me. It's been really it's a challenge, so but I have that experience as a mom to go through that and to see how important it is. So I know it from working with students and from working with clients, but I also know it personally as a mom how important it is to for humans to be affirmed.
I think Jamie Douglas makes a great point how important it is for human beings to be affirmed. No matter who you are, it's integral to have support and have love and just know that you're accepted no matter who you are.
Yeah, I think, I mean, so I was so appreciative. I know we both were so appreciative of her vulnerability and just like openness and honesty when talking to us, because I mean, yeah, like it's real and they're humans, like they deserve love. And even later in the interview when we talked about like what we can do, like it's not hard to provide gender-affirming care as people, right?
Exactly. I think that the main theme that we got from both of you and I got from interviewing her is that language is so important in affirming gender-affirming care. It can make it's so simple to change a word you're saying and just because it gives them it makes them feel like they're wanted. It feels like they're themselves, and it's a small change that makes a huge difference. Statistically, it's been proven that this affirming with language is so important.
No, literally. it's interesting because there's an interesting journal chapter titled Theorizing Trans Care by Hill Malatino that says it maybe a bit more eloquently than I can, but it says that care isn't abstract, but only ever manifested through practice, action, labor, work. It is integral to our ways of doing. Malatino goes on to call it the maintenance work that must be done so that trans folks can get about the work of living. I'll say that again because it just hit me, you know. Quote, the maintenance work that must be done so that trans folks can get about the work of living. That says that, like, trans people are people, too. They just want to live and be loved and feel safe and seen like everybody does. So to other them and to make them feel like they're different, all it takes is saying their pronouns, right? Not using their dead name. Making them feel like they're different or somehow innately less than deserving of care is wrong.
And as we end this podcast, we want to think about the next steps that need to be taken. Honestly, a number of questions come to mind. What changes need to be made in society to improve access and acceptance of gender-affirming care for trans youth? How can healthcare providers ensure that trans youth receive adequate and holistic care? And what steps should be taken to ensure that everyone has access to this critically important form of care? Even if we don't have the answers to all those questions, what do we know? What we know is that everyone can participate in gender-affirming care strategies that go a long, long way to improve the lives of trans people and make our society a more safe and inclusive one.
I think what has been made clear by this podcast today is that gender-affirming care is vital and even available here at Wabash College. While there are people who are paid to provide this care, we all can provide gender-affirming care in some capacity. It doesn't require much from us to do so, and it has a very big impact. I'm Luis Rivera.
And I'm Jordan Donsky.
Thank you all for joining us today as we examine the importance of gender-affirming care. Take care and stay well, everyone.